You are listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Kirin's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
Chapter 29.
What are they?
Asked Jilin, seeing the pinpoint dots of light ahead. Looking frantically for a place to land, Ruggum was too busy to answer. Not being particular at this point, when he saw a stand of trees with no lights nearby, he indicated they should go there. The ravens weren't nocturnal creatures, and in the dark could not see the terrain well. Unacquainted with these woods, they hesitantly made their way to the ground. The Kirins found an oak remindful of the home trees and settled in nervously for the night. The overseer never did respond to Jilin's query, nor did the youth pursue it, because he soon realized what the lights meant. He and Ruggum had entered foreign territory inhabited by humans. Both were troubled about what happened with the small human girl by the pond, and they passed a restless but uneventful night. The morning dawned bright and sunny, and after little preparation they departed. Gaining altitude, they could see that to the east were buildings and roadways constructed by humans. Several of the giant beings themselves were moving slowly on paved areas next to buildings, and Ruggum chose to circumvent the settlement. They proceeded quietly and without incident, moving off to the east, leaving the town behind.
That feels better, said Jilin, glancing back, the pocket of humans fading into the distance.
The elder didn't reply, his thoughts on their circumstances and yesterday's perplexing encounter. He knew human communities were often close together. He saw no reason to trouble Jilin with this, but as they flew on, he kept a close watch for signs of human life. Shortly they came across more of the dark strips humans used for travel, which soon crisscrossed the landscape, and more houses and towns. Ruggum considered flying to the north or south, trying to avoid the area. But, he concluded, either of those directions might take them into an even more densely populous region, and their destination was to the east. Rolling along the paved thoroughfares were many large metallic vehicles with human occupants. Jilin glided down close to them on occasion. By the end of the day, they had passed numerous human settlements, circumventing all of them. Knowing all this existed, having seen it once before, Ruggum viewed everything with interest, but also, because of Jilin, with apprehension. Jilin, seeing these things for the first time, was mystified, nervous, and curious. A semi-trailer truck was following a slowly moving white sedan along a curvy, single-lane highway. The middle-aged truck driver was eager to pass, but couldn't, and was becoming more annoyed by the moment. But his frustration all at once turned to wonder when a huge black bird swooped down, flapped along behind the car, then climbed out of sight as rapidly as it had appeared. He turned to his wife in the next seat.
"Did you see what I saw?"
"What?" she said wearily.
"On the back of that bird, there was something funny, almost looked like a small rider."
She looked at him askance. "What are you on?
Good thing I came along."
She reached for a thermos of hot coffee and poured him a mug.
"Does this happen often? Here, maybe this'll keep you awake."
The sun sank into the horizon, and Ruggum and Jilin landed and passed an uneventful night. Clouds moved in, and the next day was warm and muggy. They flew steadily, and in the middle of the day saw another human village and went around it. They came across only a few roadways, and those had few vehicles.
During the afternoon, Jilin was suddenly shaken by a sensation of horror and loss. Looking about, nothing appeared wrong. Ruggum was close at hand and flying normally. Then he knew what it was. Wherever she was, something dreadful had happened to Tally. He was devastated and haltingly told Ruggum. The elder was deeply distressed, but there was nothing whatsoever they could do. They spent the evening saying little. In his hand, Jilin held Tally's worn golden disc, the image of her great-grandmother on it, and thought and dreamed of Tally all night. The morning dawned bright and clear. Departing, Jilin's heart was heavy, but he knew they must carry on. There were no signs of humans as they flew, and Ruggum's mood lightened. They shared impressions and questions about fragments of human civilization they had seen, Jilin trying to control his emotions. "I'm wondering about their vehicles," he said. "Some are immense and appear designed to convey large amounts of material, but many are smaller and obviously intended to carry humans. Judging by the size of the smaller ones, most were built for 4 or 5 passengers. Where are they? As far as I can tell, many carry only 1 or 2. As you know, I went down a few times to get a closer look."
"I wasn't pleased with that," said Ruggum. "I'd prefer that you not do it again."
"I was curious and didn't stay long."
"If I dare to speculate on human behavior, I'll probably be wrong. But perhaps their society isn't so advanced or exact that they know how many of their kind will be moving in one direction or another at a given time. Therefore, space is wasted."
After an uneventful morning, Ruggum was relaxing.
"Jilin might be visible," he thought, "but we've passed over quite a stretch of human-inhabited territory with but one incident."
The old Kirin was enjoying the sun, the blue sky with thin white clouds, and the breeze playing over his face and ruffling his beard.
"Perhaps," he mused, "this won't be as bad as I thought."
He noticed something in the distance. Next to a lake was a small house, all by itself, no roads or other buildings around. Drawing closer, it became obvious it wasn't small at all, in fact larger than usual, 2 or 3 times the size of a normal house. But it was isolated, and in his relaxed frame of mind, even though they weren't flying very high, he saw no reason to avoid it. Approaching, he saw 3 humans standing near it. One held a shiny, metallic instrument, upraised and pointing toward the birds, and instantly Ruggum knew he had made a mistake. Chapter 30.
"We've waited a long time for this day, haven't we, Chris?" said the old man.
Wearing khaki hiking clothes and carrying a parcel, Grandpa Versteeg was negotiating the path with a decided limp. Shrapnel wounds suffered more than 40 years ago at war had caused his knee to become stiff and painful, and it was getting worse with age. He could no longer hike through the woods the way he used to, curtailing one of his greatest pleasures. But today marked a special occasion. He would pass along to his 2nd grandson some of his knowledge of guns and game hunting. There would also be a surprise, and he was enjoying the occasion so much he had almost forgotten about his leg.
"I'm glad the day's finally come," said 12-year-old Christopher cheerfully, trailing the deliberate old man. Nathan, Christopher's older brother, was in the lead. The boys had been this way since they were toddlers and knew the path well. Nathan was 14. He wore a red jacket and a blue backpack loaded with groceries and today's lunch. Growing impatient with the pace, he glanced over his shoulder, then hurried on ahead. During the 2-hour drive from the city, they had discussed firearm safety much of the way. After parking the car, they were traversing the half-mile trail through the woods. Since his days as a Marine Corps captain, John Versteeg had maintained an interest in guns and had a sizable collection. Though in his late 70s, his family considered him competent with weapons. For years, Christopher had wanted his grandpa to teach him to shoot, not because he wanted to hunt game, he still wasn't sure about that, but because he liked being with his grandpa and doing what his grandpa did. Christopher's parents insisted he wait until he was 12. His birthday was yesterday. This trip to his grandfather's hunting lodge for a first lesson in shooting was his long-awaited present. The morning was cool and pleasant, and Christopher's yellow windbreaker brightened and darkened as they passed through sunshine and shade. Unlike his brother, he was content to walk with his slowly moving grandfather. As they progressed, the old man gestured into the surrounding woods, telling tales of his hunting experiences, many related to the lake and lodge they were approaching. It was the enjoyment of hunting, which he could no longer do the way he used to, he was trying to convey to Christopher, but also its more serious aspects. "You must always respect both the weapon and the animal," he said. "Native Americans, America's first hunters, did it right. They deeply respected nature and the animals they killed, and used everything from their bodies. The flesh was consumed, the bones were made into tools, the hide into clothing and tents, the entrails into sacks. They conducted ceremonies for the animals, even apologized to the beast and its creator for having to kill it." Reaching the grassy clearing next to the lodge, the grandfather stopped. "I have a surprise for you, young man. You're not getting just a lesson for your birthday." He handed the lad the encased gun he had been carrying. The boy's eyes lit up. "For me?" "We'll see," said his grandpa. "Not right away. I'll start teaching you to use it today, and your mother and father must approve." The boy unzipped the case and removed the gleaming weapon. It was a 20-gauge, single-barreled, automatic shotgun. But it wasn't brand new. "From my collection," said the grandfather. "It's a fine piece. You'll shoot it only under my supervision, and when it's not in use, it'll be kept indoors in a locked cabinet, and I have the key. If you learn wisely and well, when you turn 18, if you want it, it can be yours." Christopher gazed at it and fondled it. "From your collection?" He was surprised and touched. "That makes it even better. Can I shoot it?" "Of course. But first you'll have to learn a few things." His grandpa took the gun. "And one of the primary ones is this." He checked to make sure it wasn't loaded, then went on. "We talked about respecting the animal or bird. You must also respect the gun. This is not a toy, but a serious weapon, and used for hunting only. You must never point it at another person." Christopher nodded. "But it's been a long morning, young man. I'm hungry. Let's go inside and get something to eat. Then we'll come back out." He glanced about. "Where did Nathan run off to with our lunch?" They crossed the clearing and the old man unlocked the door at the end of the large building. Entering the lower level, they started down the hallway, passing bedrooms and a furnace room, the grandfather switching on lights and looking into each room. "No varmints this time." They climbed a flight of stairs to the upper level. The lodge had once been burglarized, and the old man had a habit of pacing about, checking the living room, dining room, den, and kitchen. Satisfied everything was in order, he slid open a glass door and stepped onto a front deck, running the length of the lodge and overlooking the lake. Christopher followed him out. "I've always loved this," said the grandfather, resting his elbows on the railing and taking a deep breath of fresh air. He gazed out over the woods and the wide expanse of still water. "It's what I come for now." Nathan appeared in the doorway. "Where have you been, as if I didn't know?" said his grandfather. The boy had discovered a raccoon family on a recent visit and checked on them whenever he came.
Any sign of them today?
They sleep during the day, said Nathan, and come out after dark. I didn't want to get too close to their den, but last time they had a litter of four babies.
That's nice, said the old man.
Now, my friend, where's our lunch?
In the fridge, said Nathan,
and the three of them, all starving, proceeded to the kitchen. After lunch, Christopher was eager for his lesson. His grandpa picked up the gun, and Christopher followed him down the stairs and out onto the front lawn, a grassy incline dotted with yellow and white wildflowers that ran down to the lake. There the old man demonstrated several aspects of shooting the shotgun correctly.
First, your feet must be spread apart like this, and since you're right-handed, your left foot's out in front, both feet planted and solid so you have good balance. Your left hand is down on the forend, and your right is here by the trigger. When you're ready to shoot, bring the gun slowly against your shoulder like this. When you pull a rifle's trigger, squeeze it slowly, but with a shotgun, pull at any speed you want.
Nathan walked up with thoughts of his own. He had never been as close to his grandfather as Chris was. Since Chris was little, he and his grandpa had been best buddies. Overhearing his parents talking, Nathan had mistakenly understood his brother was receiving a shotgun for his birthday. That bothered Nathan.
I already know how to shoot, he thought, and I don't have one.
Oh, is this Chris's gun? He asked.
The one I intend to teach him with, said the grandfather, as I taught you.
Neat, said Nathan. Can I see it?
Yeah, but you can't shoot it, said Christopher.
Trained by his grandpa, Nathan had been shooting for almost 2 years. The grandfather sensed the older boy's disgruntlement. His mother and father had decided he was too impulsive to have a gun designated for his use. But there were signs lately that he was improving, and perhaps he soon would have one.
Here it is. The old man handed the gun to Nathan and glanced at Christopher. It's okay if he holds it.
Is it full choke? Asked Nathan.
It is indeed, said the grandfather. It gives a good shot pattern for duck hunting.
Placing the shotgun against his shoulder, Nathan aimed it out over the lake and looked down the sights. Then he lowered it and was about to hand it back to his grandpa when he caught sight of a pair of large birds approaching from the west. The grandfather turned and spoke to Christopher.
There's something else you have to learn, but it only comes with practice. When you aim at a moving target, you must lead it or you'll shoot behind it.
The two birds were black. Crows, thought Nathan, and were almost overhead. They weren't very high and seemed unusually close together. They would be easy targets. Having sneaked a couple of shells into his jacket pocket, he loaded one quickly and aimed just ahead of the birds.
"Here's how you lead them," he said.
His grandfather shouted,
"Nathan!"
As the birds passed over a pine-covered ridge, he fired. Chapter 31. As Ruggum concentrated on the three humans below, a yellow flash startled him and a thunderous discharge shook the atmosphere. Struggling to control Alsanam, he saw Loana slanting earthward, one wing not moving.
"Down!" he shouted. "Follow!"
His raven dove in rapid pursuit. He wondered frantically whether Jilin was still aboard, and soon Loana struck the ground. Touching down next to her, the elder leapt off and saw open wounds in her right wing. She was in shock and barely moving.
"Jilin," he called, "where are you?"
"Here," murmured the lad, thrown off when the raven impacted the earth.
"I'm all right."
Struggling to his feet, he touched Ruggum on the arm.
"But Loana's dreadfully injured."
"I see the wounds," said Ruggum gravely.
How did it happen?
Asked Jilin, trembling.
A human weapon.
Weapon?
I saw it. I know about them, but we haven't time.
Ruggum glanced frantically about. Some distance away was a fallen oak. He ran to it. It was decaying, and a hole was in its side. He hastened back.
We must hide the island.
And ourselves, he thought desperately.
Luana must come now.
She can't move.
She has no choice. We have no choice. Her attackers will soon be upon us.
Together they coaxed the courageous bird to her feet, and then, wing dragging, to move as resourcefully as she could at her master's side toward the fallen tree. Approaching it, Ruggum stepped inside, instructing Alcinan to follow and telling him why. The old raven had done many things in his life at the behest of his master, but entering a dark, enclosed space wasn't one of them. Nonetheless, he knew something was dangerously wrong with Luana, and his master was explaining he must do this to help their situation. He didn't hesitate and squeezed through the hole. Stepping outside, Ruggum directed Luana to enter. In pain and knowing her masters wanted only to help, she slithered inside and the Kirins followed. The space was dry, smooth, and roomy, and the ravens were quieted with whispers and gestures. Keeping out of sight, the overseer positioned himself near the opening. Within moments, shuffling was outside.
Human feet, thought Ruggum, but he didn't look.
The sound moved away, then came closer again, and he dared not look. Hearing nothing for a while, he was starting to look when he heard breathing, then saw a pair of gigantic legs kneel a short distance away. He leaned back, hardly daring to breathe, hoping desperately the human would not conclude that a wounded bird might seek a refuge like this. He glanced at Luana. It was too dark to see her wing, but he had seen blood on it earlier. He wondered whether a trail of red was on the ground outside or a smear on the edge of the hole, and he was more apprehensive than ever. The searching continued for a long while, but, luckily, the human never neared the hollow tree again. Eventually, the sounds came from farther and farther away, and finally they were gone. Nathan lowered the shotgun as one of the birds descended earthward. Christopher was stunned.
You shot them with my gun.
The grandfather was watching the birds intently. Something was happening he had never before seen in nature. After the lead bird was hit, its partner, apparently uninjured, made a sweeping turn downward and followed its companion. The old man's gaze darted to the lead bird and he stared disbelievingly. A miniature rider appeared to be clinging to it as it dropped and disappeared beyond the ridge. He glanced at the boys, who were arguing over the gun, and gave no indication of seeing what he had. Taking off his glasses, he rubbed his eyes and didn't say a word. They'd think it's my age, he thought, but it sure looked like something was there. Trying to put it out of his mind, he thought again of the birds. Never fond of crows or ravens, which he knew these to be, he still had a healthy respect for them. But he had never seen a bird behave as the second one had here, and couldn't get the image out of his mind. Maybe I was mistaken, he thought, but something strange is going on here. He glared at Nathan.
Go bring back the one you hit.
No, I will, cried Christopher, angry and frustrated. He had wanted to be the first to shoot the gun intended for him, but he was also shocked that his brother attacked two innocent creatures. Christopher had been with Grandpa Versteeg and other hunters on several occasions when game birds were brought down, and it appeared a natural occurrence. The birds, usually ducks, were cleaned and eaten in pleasant surroundings, as were fish when caught. But this was different. It might have been that it was his shotgun that was fired, and he felt responsible. Perhaps it was that these were not game fowl, but ordinary birds which would normally live free lives high in the skies, and ones he'd never consider eating. He wasn't sure what it was. His thoughts and emotions were jumbled. He only knew he was outraged and wanted to find the bird. He darted off, and his older brother made no move to follow. Crossing the ridge near the lake, he entered a grove of evergreens, certain the injured bird was there. Exploring in all directions and under every tree and bush, he found nothing. He began looking up into the trees and went back and forth several times, searching high and low, finding no trace of either bird. Puzzled and frustrated, he gave up and walked slowly back to the lodge. He went up the stairs, and his grandfather and brother were sitting in the large living room. A deadly silence greeted him. Nathan's face was flushed, and his grandfather was looking more stern than Christopher had ever seen. He surmised that his grandfather had reprimanded Nathan for needlessly shooting the bird and doing it with the shotgun meant for his brother. Christopher stood at the top of the stairs.
"I couldn't find anything."
"No matter," said the old man. "It must be there. Couldn't be anywhere else." He realized Christopher was disturbed. Maybe it was able to fly away after all. But he knew, by the way it had dropped from the sky, it was either dead or severely injured. He thought about the second raven's unheard-of behavior, diving steeply after the first, which mystified and intrigued him. But not nearly so much as what he saw on the first bird, convinced something was astride it.
Kierans, The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
To learn more about Kierans, visit www.kieranbooks.com.
You have been listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.